You're listening to Unplugged Radio,
a podcast in which a trio of longtime friends and gamers talk about media, role-playing, hobbying,
and sometimes even Kings of War.
We could keep talking over this intro song,
but John spent 30 whole minutes composing and recording it, so
instead, kick back and enjoy some sweet, sweet metal.
Hi, buddies. Welcome to another episode, right, of the Long Lost Podcast. Used to be known as Unplugged Radio 2.
Yeah, now Unplugged Radio 2.
Electric Boogaloo, right? I'm down. This is good.
We used to have this thing where we're like, I'm a host and you're a host and we're all hosts, but, you know, like, we can switch things up. It's all good.
No, I like this. This feels organic.
It's more casual.
It's informal. Casual's our style. Yeah.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Mike.
Stop it. Okay, come on. What? Okay.
Right? No, this is working. It's totally working.
So, right. Welcome to both of you, and of course to everyone out there who is listening. Thank you for your patience. Maybe this was a nice surprise to find out that Unplugged Radio has popped back up in your podcast feed. It's been a while. Life has been lifing, but we wanted to try and get back into the swing of things because we miss doing this, and we are still interested in hobbying and consuming other nerd-related media and just having a good time. So
we're still here. Yeah,
all these things are true. Excellent. So, all right, let's start with it, buddy. What have you been, John, of all people? What have you been doing in the hobby? What are you up to?
Oh, man. You know, I feel like this is not a fair question, to be honest. I have been really good about posting pictures.
You have been.
So, all right, let me say this. This is what I've been up to in the hobby. My sister follows me on Instagram, and I post all the same pictures to the Facebook channel that I do to Instagram. That's my social. My social media is just pictures of stuff I painted, basically.
Yeah.
So, my sister follows me, and she says, John, your pictures they're fine, they're cool, like it's nice to see that, but what is with this blue white background? Like, get real, man. And so for Christmas she got me some nice photo backdrops in like 20 different colors, and they're much bigger than the one I had previously.
I have seen those. I was wondering, because you've had that blue white background going for like close to 20 years.
probably 15. Long time. So I'm very good about posting pictures. They don't always get posted like the day that I finish painting something, but within a week usually or so, pictures go up. And so I've painted fantasy models and sci-fi models and models for other games and 5mm models and 30mm models. But they're getting new pictures now, so I'm experimenting with different background colors, and so that's been fun. You will see pink backgrounds and red backgrounds and color shifts. Maybe I'm going to try some bicolor backgrounds at some point where I do like two colors that have a hard break between them. So you just wait. You guys are going to see some interesting pictures.
Okay. I mean, I'm really interested in the color that's on your models, but I do appreciate the background talk. Right. Just letting you know.
Okay.
It can make a big difference though in the way, because it provides contrast, right? So it can change the way it looks.
Yeah, I can't remember which model it was that I painted recently. I'm just gonna make something up. It was a lightly colored model, and then I put it on my blue white background, it just like washed the colors out. It had nothing to like make it stand out. And so I really think it does matter whether you want to go like full black or full, like if you paint something that's mostly black or dark browns or fur. Maybe you want a white background, but I've been having fun messing with the colors a little bit. Like I was photographing some Skaven. I put a green background because they're Skaven rats.
Yeah.
But then I tried some other. I had some green guys. I put a red background on. So yeah,
it's cool.
This is my fun. But been painting like a fiend. It's the thing that works with my life schedule.
Right.
You know, evening, kids go to bed. That's I can't get out and get a game necessarily, but I can do that. So,
right. So you've been D&Ding though, right? I mean, you sent me a message about D&Ding with the family, right? Over holiday.
So D&Ding with the normal D&D group, but I gave up after 13 years, I passed the Dungeon Master torch on there.
Yeah.
But D&D with the kids, I think I talked about this earlier, but it's been fun. We kind of finished our first game. I don't know what to call it. It's a rule set, right? And it had 20 maybe published adventures that came with it. And I think we have one of them left actually that I don't know if we'll ever finish at this point. They're not connected strongly, right. So it doesn't really matter. But I found this company out of they're on the West Coast. I think they're in like Portland, Oregon. It's called D&D Adventures Club, and they make kid themed adventures that are a little bit more compatible with just like straight up 5th edition D&D rules. And they're pretty contained. They're supposed to take a couple of hours to play through. It's got a book with some nice maps and some nice, you know, plot hooks and some simple combat rules. And the idea is you get it on a subscription, and you know, you just get one in the mail every 2 weeks or something like that.
Okay.
I just bought some of the older ones that they had out of their catalog.
Sure.
So that's what we're gonna play next. I actually haven't tried them yet, so I'm not sure how that's gonna go. But in theory, it sounds fun, and like the publication quality on them is pretty nice. For they were only like $7 a piece or something like that.
Okay.
But the kids are having a blast with it. Sometimes it's a little bit tough to get my wife to want to do it, but she always has fun whenever we play. And then she's I do like this. This is a good
she doesn't
time.
Regret afterwards, right? It's just a question of like mustering it up.
Yeah, you know? and the kids eat it up. Like I got my daughter's been playing a spellcaster, and so I was like, well, you have to have a somatic component to your spells, right? Like this is part of it. Right. And so she's, you know, they got the kids making up like funny ways to do their spells and stuff like that, and yeah, just having really fun time.
It's pretty awesome.
And keeping it lightweight for kids, because I'm not our main group is playing Curse of Strahd. It's horror themed. Everything is like freaking creepy and weird.
Oh yeah,
and, like that. You know, I'm not doing that with an 8-year-old.
No.
But
absolutely not.
But the little, like, you know, meeting up in the fairy village and having to figure out why the toad stole the magic mushroom or something, like, you know, that's cool. That works.
That's totally their speed, right? And they love it.
They love it.
Right.
They love kind of that just playing in a magic world. To be able to do cool things, and they enjoy getting into fights. You know, my son wants to fight all the time. We did one adventure a couple weeks ago, and he was like, "Dad, there was only like 2 fights in that whole adventure." And I was like, "Yeah, you did a lot of exploration." He's like, "Ah, I wanted to hit stuff."
I love that, right? It's awesome, right? But you did a Christmas one, right? Where they had to figure out like what happened. Santa Claus got
that I told you guys about that. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
That one was really fun, and it was a little bit unexpected, because I didn't tell the kids that I had made a Christmas themed adventure, and it was like, you know, a couple of days before Christmas that we did this. So I took an adventure that was technically more like pagan holiday themed, Odin and Fenris and it was using kind of some of that Norse. There were other things mixed in there as well. Sure. But I was like, but the bones of this adventure work fine in terms of like there's encounters and there's mechanics and there's a storyline that goes through it. So I just need to Christmas this up a little bit. So we still they ate it up, by the way. They was lovely. So they were in a village, and they had to first, I can't remember exactly how I said it, but something like Santa's stuck. Like, we haven't heard from him, and the adults are like, "Kids, we can't go to the land of Santa. Like, you have to go figure out what's going on. You know, this magical realm. We can't go there." And so the kids are like, "All right, yeah, we're gonna go." And so they go out into the forest, and they encounter some not fairies, elves, Christmas elves, right?
Yes.
The elves live in the forest, and they're like, "Hey, we got to find Santa." And the elves are like, "Yeah, but we can't just bring you to Santa. Like, you got to prove that you're worthy." And so they end up in like this.
Makes perfect sense.
Make for obviously, right? So they end up in these duels of strength with the elves in the forest.
That is amazing.
And the elves like lead them up into the mountains, and they get attacked by wolves in the woods, and they've got to overcome like getting there's an avalanche in the mountains, and they encounter an abominable snowman. And then they get to Santa's place and realize that he's been poisoned or something. He's unconscious, and none of the elves are there, and none of the presents are ready. And so they find Rudolph in the backyard, and he's got to fly them around, and they have to find the antidote for the poison. And so they save Christmas, basically, is the bottom line.
Amazing, right? By the way, right?
It was super fun. They loved it. You know, it was right on point with the theme. So it was great.
So great. Cool. We've been doing, on the D&D front, we've been doing Pathfinder, which is a really...
It's for a while now. You've been at this for like 3 years, maybe? Two years?
Well, we're coming up on like the middle of our second year of running through this campaign. I love this campaign. I cannot stand Pathfinder.
Oh.
It is complex. It's complex for the point of being complex. It's a lot. But it's called Kingmaker, and the idea is like we're characters.
You're still playing Kingmaker.
Yeah, dude, but we're near like the end. It's okay. Like I feel like we're getting close to the end. Like we're doing some really
it's
cool
funny
stuff,
because
right?
Because that would be 2.5 years would be like warp speed for the group that John and I are part of.
Well, yeah.
But for Rossi, 2.5 years feels like an eternity because his group moves so much more efficiently through there.
Right. We're flying along at 18 months, and I think we're level 13, you know.
Oh my gosh.
We're getting stuff done, right? But like it is I don't know. It's super cool. I'm glad we're doing it. It is also really Kyle has had to redo a bunch of the mechanics of everything to get it to work. Right.
Okay, I'm interested in that, but hang on a second. I'm wondering like what parts, so I've never played Pathfinder. I played a Pathfinder video game once.
Sure.
But what parts of the mechanics do you find clunky?
So for Kingmaker, you essentially have rules for your characters, and you also have rules for administering and building the kingdom, right?
Uh-huh. Right.
And so right. And so the way the game works is that you're incentivized to grow, like it's a hex map, and you're incentivized to grow the kingdom as fast as you can because it gives you more resources that allow you to do stuff. But the larger your kingdom, the harder your target numbers become.
Okay. So you gotta try to stack bonuses and stuff.
Right. And so essentially you're building so you invest. Like you roll all these dice with all these. If you fail a roll, it's every negative consequence is like half your building's burned down or your people are starving. I mean, I'm being overly. Oh. I mean, I'm over the top, but it is pretty tough. Like the chance, like if you fumble a roll on a kingdom something or other, it's bad, right? And meanwhile, like if you pass, you get +1 to the next roll you do on a 20-sided dice for this other thing. And it's like the risk reward is awful and it doesn't scale right. So in the beginning, we're like, this is cool. Like 50% you know, just over half the time we're going to pass. And if you crit, you get this extra little bonus. If you get a 1, it's okay. That's fine. But like, because the kingdom gets bigger, but you don't actually get bonuses to your stats to overcome the difficulty, eventually you're like, I need a 15 or more on this basic check to do a thing.
Oh.
And if I fail, it's bad. And if I roll a 1, it's super bad. And so we got to a point where we're like, we can't actually, it spent more like time just fiddling around with the kingdom rules than we were adventuring and playing. And Kyle's like, we can't do this anymore. Right. Like this, we were like, this is clearly broken. We went online and everyone was like, yes, the Kingmaker stuff is clearly broken. Right. And if you want to fix it, these are some things you could fix it or you could just ignore it. And so we just talked to him. We were like, we're just going to ignore that part of the game. But that is reflective in other stuff. It's like, I'm going to get this super cool feat that gives me +1 to my die roll to do this thing. Awesome. Right. So like it, I don't know. It's very like the rules.
Very customizable.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing. But for example, the rules to dispel a spell. are super complex, and they are in five different parts of the rules. That's bonkers, yeah. Right? You have to do this, then you have to go to this page, to this page, to this page, to this page, and then after all said and done, roll this dice, and here's your bonus. Okay, but I'm sorry. Listen, I'm not redactive at all. Like, I don't want to make everything like theater of the mind, but at the same time, it's like this added complexity isn't working for us in the group. Mm. You know what I mean? Especially when we're drawn to other role-playing games that are actually just easier. You know, like the mechanics are easier. You don't have to worry about it. Like, I'm looking at one. I want to run a couple one-shots for a game called Visen, which is set in Norway. And it has to do with gothic horror, fairy type stuff. It's like the background is super cool. You are part of a society that essentially investigates fae creatures, right? And some of them are bad, and some of them are good. And as industrialization, it's set in the late 1800s. So as industrialization is happening throughout Norway, it's actually changing people's relationship to the land and the relationship with the fae creatures. It makes it so it's gone from a symbiotic relationship to an antagonistic relationship. And so you have to go and deal with this. And it has to do with societal change and all this other really cool story stuff. And you have three sets of three stats with a number value of 1 to 3. Right. And then every time you take damage, you lose a point of whatever stat you tried to fail. Or whatever, whatever you did, you know what I mean? So as the game goes on, your effectiveness in certain areas goes down, right? Yeah. You have bonuses, you add
wear and tear,
plus one or plus two. It does, right? You may add one or two to your checks to do a thing, but you still only have those three essentially hit points in each of those categories. It's super easy and super cool, right? And I'm itching to run a game of that. It's a different... I don't think you need complexity to be able to tell a really good story and have people kind of invested in what's going on, right? You know what I mean?
Totally. I mean, I agree with you 100%. I don't think you need the complexity. The complexity can add some things to it, though. We did a...
Absolutely.
What was it? A Cthulhu... Fate of Cthulhu. Like, the Fate rules are pretty streamlined, too. They're really based around story.
They certainly are.
Yeah. And, it was... I think that rubbed against some of the players more than others. I enjoyed it for what it was.
Sure.
It was more narrative. But I had a question for you about the group here. And has anybody in your group played Frosthaven or Gloomhaven?
Gloomhaven. We're actually, we had Mindy and Corey Kyle and I are doing Jaws of the Lion right now. But we've done Gloomhaven. It's cool. It is so well balanced.
So well balanced. But if you haven't done Frosthaven and you haven't done the admin of building a city yet, and I was wondering how Kingmaker compared against Frosthaven. That was kind of the root of my question. But you,
I haven't played it.
Okay.
But I want to.
But you, but I will eventually.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. It's good.
Cool. So I mean, that's what we've been up to. I also have been doing a lot of pub for the book. Being on podcasts and stuff, and I guess Countercharge is going to be doing their Lore Masters Library, so it's like a 4-hour episode on the book with people. So that's coming up in a couple weeks after Dead of Winter. I'm recording that, and then I'm running Dead of Winter. So I got all the lists submitted yesterday. Got a couple of the errors figured out, so I have to, once I get done here, I have to post out a link to everybody so they can look at the list. But we'll talk about that in a couple minutes, because that's its own set of things.
Set of Winter something. Yeah.
Yeah, it's super cool. But Greg's gonna be there, so I'm excited. Yep.
That's that's what's gotten me excited, motivated to pick up my Clash of Kings book and give it an actual cover to cover read through.
Right.
It's been a long time since I've done any hobby things. So the fact that I was able to make room in my schedule to attend was a big deal.
Super
and
excited.
I can't wait.
Right. It's gonna be cool. But yeah, buddy. All right. So Greg, you have been essentially crafting a little human, right, with your hobby time?
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, it's a lot harder than just working with like plastic or metal or resin or green stuff. Actually, sculpting a real human.
Yeah.
It's a lot more.
Can't just thin it down. You thin down that paint, right?
Yeah. So in terms of like hobby stuff, I said I haven't done anything since Crossroads, which I had done quite a bit of prep or various things up to Masters and Crossroads, and then I kind of came crashing down. But I'm excited for the Clash changes. We'll talk about those a little bit and seeing how they play out at Dead of Winter. I'm also getting back into our D&D group. I've also not really been able to make those events, but I'm looking forward to our next session. I did convert my character over using the new player's handbook. So again, like I grabbed that when I came out because we were going to start adopting rules, and because I knew I wasn't able to make sessions, it wasn't motivating me to put in the time investment, but I did, and I was glad. So both of these things are exciting to me, and they're right on the horizon.
Super cool, right?
Coming together.
Yeah. So what have you been watching? Or other media stuff? Like, I'm totally down with sharing media stuff right now.
Yeah, I've been in a weird, like, since Crafting a Human, it's put me in like a weird nostalgia phase. Like, I've always been, for maybe like the past 10 years, somewhat invested in like the things that I liked when I was a teen. I mean, that's when I started miniature wargaming. But it's, for me, it's specifically been like 90s stuff. So I've been like reading books from the 90s, watching TV shows from the 90s, but not all exclusively like stuff I already knew, but like stuff that I tangentially was like, I remember hearing about that when it was out and thinking it was cool, but I never checked it out. So let me go and do that now.
Right.
And that's just, yeah. But it's fun. We're watching, I got my wife watching some things with me too. So we're watching this,
really,
this sitcom called Living Single, which season one, I think, was from 1993. And it's, it came out before Friends. And a lot of people kind of point out that Friends just like aped its premise. It's a group of male and females who live in this apartment complex, like next to each other in New York City, and they're young adults and they're trying to navigate life.
Got it.
And it features a young Queen Latifah. Ooh. So that's been like classic kind of corny. Sitcom.
Was this something that like you wanted to watch when you were growing up and you didn't, or you did watch it and you're enjoying rewatching it?
No, you know, this one I hadn't heard of, but like many other people in like a 10-year age range above or below me, I did see Friends, and so when I heard about this, I was like, oh, I kind of want to see that. And my wife was like, yeah, I used to watch that a little bit back in the day. So
nice.
Yep
That's cool. So I started Way of Kings because so Sam
finally
right, well, he came out with his fifth book, which is the end of the arc, and so I started reading it, which is, it's really good. Everybody was like, Mike, you should read this. Yeah, you're totally right.
Where are you right now?
I am 7% of the book in.
So you've just scratched the surface.
Just scratched the surface, right?
Yeah.
Just scratched the surface.
Go ahead, John.
I'm most of the way through Rhythm of War, so I haven't quite started Wind and Truth yet, but I'm getting pretty close to being ready to start that. And as I was reading your book, Mike, as I was reading Honor's Price at the same time, it was hard not to make comparisons in certain literary style. And so I took some notes about Honor's Price that maybe we'll talk about later. And I was going to make some Sanderson comparisons from Stormlight Archives.
Wow. That's high praise, I think. Unless it's, these are all the things I didn't like about the Stormlight Archives. Besides that, right? Listen, if we get through you reading a book and being like, I think it was okay, I'll take that as the highest praise ever, to be honest. Right? Right? Not gonna lie.
I've been known to be a harsh critic.
So I'm really looking forward to your opinion on this. Because I'm about to sign a contract to write another book.
Oh
hell yeah.
So there you go. There
cool.
It is.
That's awesome.
In my email box tomorrow.
Wow. So
that'll be awesome.
And and is this gonna be a sequel to Honest Price or is it a completely different story?
It's not.
Because I know totally I think I remember you talking about how you had some ideas for a sequel, but also ideas for other.
Yeah, so I spoke to Brandon Respond and I said, "Hey buddy, what do you think the chances of me getting a sequel done are?" And he said, "Not good." And I said, "Well, is it because of Dwarf Overload?" He's like, "Yeah. You know, like there's supposed to be a dwarf trilogy, and then I'll, you know, if five of the next 10 books."
Doesn't he know two out of three podcast hosts on this specific podcast will read anything and everything dwarf related?
That is true. I keep telling him like dwarfs are an easy win, but you know, what do I know? So there's that. Right. But that is happening.
Nice. Okay. That's a very exciting.
It's super cool. So I can, once again, I am wriggling out of painting by finding any other excuse that I can find, to not put paint on a mini.
But this is the best kind of excuse, though.
It counts, I guess.
Maybe, right? Tough to tell.
I did want to share, it's such a coincidence that you brought up Way of Kings, because earlier today, the end of the school day, a couple of my high school students, current and former, came into my room just to chat a little bit, and they saw, I've always in the back of my room had like a bookshelf with just like books for anyone to borrow, like a classroom library. But I recently expanded it quite a bit when I took a lot of my own personal books from the house because we were trying to clear up space. And I said, what the hell? I'm just going to put these in my classroom and see. And so it's a lot of, you know, among other things, a lot of fantasy. And they were looking and they're like, oh my gosh, Mr. Person, you have so much fantasy right now. You have so much fantasy. Oh, and we started this like huge impassioned discussion about a bunch of their favorite authors, one of which is Brandon Sanderson, but they've mostly read some of his YA stuff and like the Mistborn trilogy.
Mistborn.
I was like, and they picked up Way of Kings because it's over there because I have the hardcover.
It's like a Venus flytrap.
Oh man, you could do squats while you're reading that, and you're gonna be jacked. By the time you finish, you'll be like Kel, I'm carrying the bridge. But one of my students was like, "All right, Mister, I don't know if you're ever gonna get this back, but I'm gonna try and read it."
Oh, that's amazing.
He took it home, and I was like, "Yes, good luck."
So great, so great. I'm glad
you're starting it, Mike. It's good. Good.
Yeah.
It's a whole world. I mean, you're deep diving now. You're going all in.
Yeah. Well, it's such a difference between my wife and I. So my wife reads like a fiend, and a couple, like she knew the fifth book was coming out, and this was like 6 weeks ago. And so she goes, "I'm going to reread all the Stormlight Archives." And I think that, literally it was 7 weeks ago and she read them all.
No.
And just, she's midway through the fifth book right now.
What?
That's intense.
She had time over Christmas. So I'm, you know, but still, oh my God. Right. She is. Yeah. The savage.
She's a machine.
Right? A machine.
That's impressive.
Yeah, dude. It sounds fake. Right. Crazy. So that is what I've started reading.
That's what you're reading,
right?
Well, so I'm on the tail end of that. I'm most of the way through Rhythm of War.
Yeah.
Definitely enjoying it. I'm not like in a rush to get to Wind and Truth. I also looked like one of these Cosmere guides about the order you should read things in, and it is suggesting reading like four different other books before going to Wind and Truth, because he wrote all of those books during the pandemic of like Tress in the Emerald Sea and Warbreaker.
So
they all fill it. Well, a bunch of, they're obviously Cosmere connections. And so Hoyt is in them, or I guess in some cases. And so it's like, I don't know, maybe you want to do that before you go into the, you know, the newest, latest piece. So,
sure.
We'll see. I haven't decided yet. I didn't read everything else in like the recommended order and it was fine. So we'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, I haven't read I haven't read Rhythm of War yet. That's I'll start it eventually, but it's
sure.
It's been like probably a year and a half since I finished the third book, and right. I was like,
another
I
giant book. So like, how much? Yeah, how much are you gonna do? It's a lot.
I'm always concerned that I'm not gonna be able to remember, right? Mm-hmm. Like what is happening? You know,
which I don't know. That problem,
you can always look up summaries online. You know.
Right? It's true, right? I keep forgetting, like, that's even the thing.
Yeah, I haven't really had an issue. I actually think the series, the Stormlight Archives, is pretty fluid. Like, there's not a lot going on that would ruin the story if you didn't remember. Like, I remember reading the Wheel of Time and just being completely lost. Every single book I read was like a freaking disaster trying to get through it, trying to remember all these people and these names. But the Stormlight Archives series... the main characters stay more or less consistent. There's not a bajillion characters coming and going. So I think I wouldn't worry so much about that, Mike. I think you'd be okay.
Cool. Yeah, I know. The Wheel of Time is the reason why I have rules.
Right.
About, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's exactly. I'm not reading your crap until it's done. Exactly. I can't deal with your 75 side characters that don't go anywhere. You know, I mean, George R. R. Martin doesn't do me any favors either, but still,
nope.
Like,
nope.
You know, like, yeah, can we just write single one-offs, please? Tell me a story in 500 pages. But
well, so you told us one in 333, so pretty good.
That is true. So the only other thing that I want to bring up that's like I've been binging is for podcasts. I discovered a podcast called The Three Ravens. And it is the Three Ravens podcast, and it has to do with English folklore. And so they started by going to each of the counties in England and talking about folklore from each of the counties. And it's this husband and wife team. It's actually really entertaining. And then they also have like mini series, right? On like local, they do local legends. They do bestiary episodes. Right. So like, you know, here's all the lore about elves. They do stuff on magic and medicine. So here's all the stuff about like cultuses or the Zodiac or whatever. Right. So it's really interesting because I'm reading or I'm listening to it and I'm just getting all these ideas about story ideas for D&D and other stuff like that. It's really, really well done. Really well done. And I begin listening to something, I'm like, all right, I'm going to read, you're on, there's 200 episodes of this, and go. You know what I mean? So, one of these days, I'm going to get an Audible subscription, I'm going to stop listening to podcasts, I'm going to listen to, like, Dungeon Crawler Carl and other stuff, but for now, I'm doing this. Right? But Three Ravens, it's worth putting in your ears. Pretty good.
Cool. Three Ravens.
Yeah, dude. But any other media I should be listening to or watching?
Nothing notable on my side. I've definitely read a bunch of candy junk stuff, but like, you know, nothing worth recommending.
Right? Wicked.
I saw a little blurb today. It was somebody saying that audiobooks play an important role in our language development in the modern world, because this was the argument. Bear with me here. It's just something I found on the internet. She was saying that when you, in especially modern society, reading is the only place where we typically encounter formal language, like language constructs. So this is the grammar of the English language. We don't talk that way. And when you read that way from a book, you actually skip most of the words. And when you have to listen to a book, it's the only place where you actually hear and comprehend every single word, the sentence structure. And it's almost like preserving formal language in a way. It's the argument.
Wow.
It's interesting.
That's cool. That's really cool.
And I'd never really thought about it like that before.
Right. I mean, you know, why would you? It's interesting. Right. I do. When you read, one of the things that I really like in some authors is they will, well, let me rephrase that. One of the hangups that I have is there are some authors who write dialogue as if people speak as if they read, or they speak as if they write. Does that make sense? You know, like the language that they say sounds stilted. It doesn't sound real, you know, because there is a certain amount of vernacular. There's a certain amount of slang. There's a certain amount of lack of structure when we speak. And I like it. And I don't like it when authors don't reflect that in the language. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. Because
it sounds fake, you know?
My kids are school age, so they're reading all kinds of different novels for class, and they've read a bunch of things that where the speech is particularly trying to mimic the South in the 1800s or England in the 1650s or something.
So they write it phonetically, right?
They write it phonetically, you know? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. For whatever that's worth, right? And I actually kind of, that's kind of a slog too when you're reading it, but I appreciate the effort of that, you know, as opposed to everybody, you know, the Queen's English.
Right? Yeah, it's different. But
it's cool. All right, so before we talk about Kings of War, I need to know, John, what you thought of my book.
I just finished it tonight, so I don't read a lot of word books. I don't sit down and read very often. Typically, when I'm traveling, and I took a vacation in December and I started it, and I didn't quite finish it. And so I came home after the holiday break here, and I said I got to finish my freaking book. So because I was enjoying it and I wanted to finish it. Okay, so I took some notes. So I tried to structure this a little bit so I can give you real feedback. And you're hearing this live and unedited, folks.
Live and for the first time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's some things I like about it, some things I don't like about it, and then I just have some questions that I think would left me confused.
Sure, lay it on me.
All right, what do you want to hear first?
Whatever order you want to go in.
I'm gonna ask the questions first then.
Right.
All right. So this is plot questions. So if you haven't read the book yet, maybe cover your ear holes and you don't want to hear pieces of this, perhaps. I was confused as to why they the pronunciation of these words, man. Help me out. Linger Caddo.
Linger Caddo. Yeah. So just so you're aware, all of the Free Dwarf stuff is based on Welsh. And I didn't make up any of the names.
Okay.
Unless it was people, like people I did, but all the place names, they were all given to me.
That's right? Totally fine. Yeah. And I figured it was like, that's
because you're not the only person. It's like, how do I pronounce this? Why would you do this to me? Right. And I'm like, it's just let you know. It wasn't.
Okay. So outside of the words being part of the world and you were given something to work with there, I don't understand. And maybe this is not supposed to be, but it was confusing to me why they lost the holds in the first place and how, after just 10 years, they were able to rebuild a population to the point where they could go fight a war now against an entrenched enemy. Right. And so, like, I had a little bit of trouble buying the premise that they got, like, overrun and just completely trounced defending their hold. And then all of a sudden, they've been exiled and now they're strong enough to come back. And like, where did that Abyssal Dwarf army come from? There's very little premise, maybe intentionally, and that's fine. Or maybe that's part of another book that I didn't read, so I was lost on some of the Abyss storyline. I don't know, but that was my thought. I was like struggling with how did they come back to retake their homeland? Like, how are they not completely devastated in the process of losing in the first place?
That is an excellent question. So the whole premise of the book is predicated on the information from the Edge of the Abyss.
Edge of the Abyss, yeah, okay.
Right. So when Edge of the Abyss, I want to make sure it's Edge of the Abyss. It was I'm actually looking it up.
Well, the Edge of the Abyss story arc, was there a particular novel that described some of it?
No. So just all I was told was you're going to write this story. This is happening. So it was actually, they sent me an early draft of the Edge of the Abyss book. So this is how long ago. Remember, this is 2020, right?
Yeah. Okay. When 2021, maybe.
Somewhere in there, right? And so it was totally cool. This is the state of play. This is what's happening. The Abyss erupts. the dwarves are thrown out of the Halpi Peninsula and they're taking refuge in Golic Town. Okay, with the Imperial dwarves. That was and as part of this as part of the supplement, here's all the lore that goes into that, right? Okay. And the lore says that the free dwarves are marching back to go and recapture, right, their homeland. Oh, I'm sorry, it wasn't Edge of the Abyss, it's Halpi's Rift.
Halpi's Rift, yeah.
Halpi's Rift. So in the Halpi's Rift book, it talks about the dwarves coming back and they're marching and they're gonna go and there's a rift there, and Dravik Dalkin finds the rift, and all this other stuff is happening in that book. And so it was set during that time period, and I was told, you have your clan go back to this location and retake that spot as the first part of that story. I said, okay, no problem. I then sent a bunch of questions. When I read Halpi's Rift, I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Right? So, buddy, I'm asking the same thing you are. And they're like, dude, yeah, it's story. Shut up. And I said, yes, sir, Matt Gilbert, sir. No problem. And then I, right. Now, meanwhile, the story has progressed since there. Like the stuff that Ben is writing and the stuff that came out in the third edition rule book, the lore that came out of that. It's all encapsulated in there.
Okay.
A lot of your questions are in there, right?
Okay.
But like the lore from the third ed book is a separate PDF that you have to upload. It's not part of the, you know, remember the rules that, like the rules in the red book are just the rules now, right? You want the lore, you got to go somewhere else. So it's, I'm not surprised that people are like, I don't even know what's happening here, right?
Okay. So then let me revise that. I mean, I understand you're working with an environment here, and actually that's one of my not good or bad criticisms. You are constrained by the world you're in here. So that is what it is. I guess it would have made more sense to me, again, having just finished the story, just got to the end, it would have made more sense to me if like multiple exiled clans had gotten together to take over a hold or something. But this idea of this one clan getting their butts kicked and then somehow being able to go back and counter kick butt just didn't like make sense to me.
Right.
Well, you see, John, when a dwarf mommy and a dwarf daddy love each other very much, they can have a baby delivered on Stoneclaw.
Oh, on the Stoneclaw. Oh, good.
Everyone knows, right?
Yes.
Delivered by Raven.
And they have a very short gestational period, so they can regrow their population.
Oh, dwarfs repopulate very immensely faster. And they build, they train as warriors from 6 months old.
It is now.
Yeah, it's not okay. All right.
You've never been a dwarf player. You don't understand these things.
Dwarf was my first fantasy army, Greg Person, in 1995. Thank you very much. Right.
Back in the day.
These are my credentials.
That's right.
He's a long beard, folks. He's
right, back when Queen Latifah was rapping, she wasn't on TV.
Yeah, that's right. So I was painting my dwarves yellow and then dipping them in pen ink. Thank you very much.
Oh, boy. Wow, really?
Dude, when you are 10 years old and you've got a white dwarf and it says put paint and ink on your model, and you have
I'm sorry, buddy. Yeah. 95, man, I went down
to the basement and I grabbed a can, like a 1 gallon can of wall primer from my parents had, and I dipped my models in it because they said I had to prime my models.
Wow, buddy.
Yeah. And then I literally broke a pen in half and poured it over the models because it said you should put ink over the models to give shading. Like,
that's amazing.
It was the world. There was no, like, I don't know.
Very,
I didn't have a mentor.
You were a great problem.
There was no internet.
No, yeah. But literally you killed a demon to get AOL to work. Everyone knows.
I made the sacrifice. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. When we started up, it was in seventh grade and we picked up some fantasy and 40K models at the same time. And one of our friends, he couldn't afford, like, you know, his parents weren't going to buy him the paint. So he had a Space Marine army that was all done using, like, actual nail paint. Like, nail polish.
He didn't have
brushes. He just used what was in the nail polish right on the Space Marines.
Yeah. Wow, dude.
You work with what you got, you know?
Yeah.
Clearly.
That's my long beard cred, though.
Sure. I started the same year you did. I was a junior in college. Sophomore in college. FML.
Well, hey, listen, we all have ages. Yours just happens to be a lot higher than mine, okay?
That's right. Scoreboard. Oh, wait, you're closer to death. That's not winning. That's like playing. I have the highest score in golf. All right. So anyway, so okay. Any other questions from you about?
No, that's just that it was just that part yeah. of the story felt a little
right.
So I tried, on the foundation.
Yeah. So I tried to cast that in such a way where in the beginning of the book, you see Drozun is like, all right, I'll stay here, but I'm sending most of my people away. Right. So I have a hardcore group of warriors here. We're going to hold off and we're going to buy time.
So that everybody else can get away safely.
Yeah. And that was kind of like the way that I justified it. Cause you're right. Like there's no way that a clan that could take a beating like that and then come back in that fashion, right?
So unless they had help, like, right?
Right.
And that came across. And I got and that part. Yeah, there was this like heroic last stand to sacrifice for the people. I got that. But like if that was the case, like why did they lose in the first why didn't they just fight? What was so overwhelming about the abyssal forces coming in that they couldn't hold?
Right. Okay.
Or they didn't even want to try to hold.
No, it's interesting. So once again, like in that Halpy's Rift book, it's like the rift erupts and there's just demons and
hell spewing forth
everywhere.
It's, yeah. Okay,
and it was
yeah.
like it's three paragraphs of background.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's just like overwhelming. Just hell erupts and everything right. goes to
everything
shit.
Goes to hell. Yeah.
Yeah. Right? yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. All right. So that's kind of a plot question that I had.
Sure.
Let me go into some of the things I liked about it. I thought that the story, plot holes aside, the story was pretty well done. Like it was fluid and it was engaging. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, it really is a thing about flow. Like the pace was good. I wasn't ever getting lost in the story where I didn't know what was going on. I also wasn't ever bored. So there was like it didn't wander on side quests. It didn't go off on these long diatribes about the history of some character. There was a little bit of like, you know, a spot where somebody is remembering something or a dream, dream sequence, right. but a little bit of history, but they were contained enough and they felt applicable enough to the moments that
there was no big info dump.
Yeah.
And it was no big
hard
info
to stay
dump.
Away from that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I really thought that across the whole novel, the flow was well done. Nice. And so that kept it interesting to keep going. I'm just going back to Sanderson. I mean, those books are freaking epics. And I think Sanderson does it better than George R. R. Martin did. But like some of those authors are known to go off. It's like they're added 100 pages for the sake of just because they wanted to put paper in the book.
Right. Right. Or they had an idea and it's like not all ideas are worth exploring.
Yeah, you know exactly. I mean? Exactly. Yeah. So there's none of that going on. And granted, this is a 300 page book, not a 1,000 page book. So of course it has to be a little bit more contained into the point. But for a book that's coming in at 300 some odd pages, I think you want the story to stay engaging and moving along. You're not trying to write an epic. You're trying to write a story that's fun to read. Right. That's the
right.
And so. It came across well. I will say that, you know, it was really hard not to read it in the voice of Mike Rossi. And, you know, there's so many moments where I could hear Mike writing these words and I could hear his wife in the background telling him that it sounds ridiculous or that that's perfect. And like, I could hear you guys like playing back and forth.
Yes.
Reading in an exasperated
which
tone.
It was so fun. It was fun.
That I love. And the reason why I say I love it is because it was completely unintentional. But Keith Randall read it, right? Because he was one of the people that I sent it to early. I was like, hey, what do you think about this? And he was like, I got to say that he had a lot of the same things that you said that were good. But he said a couple of the characters, their inner voice is the same voice. And it's your voice.
It's Mike.
And I was like, yeah, you're right. Uh-huh. I need to get on that. Right. So I toned down a couple of the characters that sounded like that. And I changed them around a little bit. Right. But depending on who it is, like, I'm sorry, Darun is... Yep. Yeah,
yes.
Darun's inner voice is me.
That's one of your personalities. Yeah, exactly.
And Reese, when he's doing his little side talking to himself, mm-hmm. is totally me.
It's totally you.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah.
They might look at that and say, like, oh, that's part of like the dour dwarf personality a little bit. But look, there's some humor mixed in there and some of these like kind of side inside joke chuckles going on. But what knowing you, it's just like, oh, that's Mike. And also, you know, I think as an author, right, it's probably hard to get out of your head.
Very hard. Very hard. Because whenever I was trying to do something else, it came across, I wrote it stilted. Like I was saying, like, this sounds formal. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so being able to balance that is hard. Hard to do.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. 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 Okay. So that was, hearing the Mike Rossi was super fun for me to read that. Knowing you, you know, it's got your name on the book. That's super cool. Hey, I know Mike Rossi. Right. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, I know this.
I thought it took on the feel of Kings of War pretty well. And I want to talk a little bit about the battle scenes and stuff, but, you know, it is a Kings of War novel. It's set in that setting, which I think is both a good and a bad thing. And so it had, you know, you're using the descriptions, and this is one of the things I maybe didn't like a little bit, was you're constrained by Kings of War terminology. So to make it fit in the world, and it makes sense. So in a way it's good and bad, right? When you talk about the battles and you're talking about troops and hordes and regiments, it's like, you know, it's like you're playing a game and here's the troops and you've got the names of the troops. And when you say the Ratkin slaves attack, it's like you could have used different words to describe that. And if I was reading a Sanderson book, it would have probably used words that felt more fluid, but you're in a world that's constrained by the world you're in.
Exactly.
And so you're trying to make a connection to the game world or the lore world, not just write an open-ended story. And so I think that came across a little bit as, yes, this connects it into the Panathor world, but also it feels a little bit forced at times.
Yeah, I totally see that. Right. Right. Because the key is to, there's two things at play here. The first one is that it is set in a world with established names for things. And like, the editing process, it was, dude, the name for this is this. I was like, all right, fine. Right. But then the other part of that is I am essentially writing for people who play Kings of War who also read.
Right. Right.
So I've got
plenty of your audience. Right.
You know what I mean? It that's exactly it. Right.
It totally makes sense. But reading the Stormlight Archives, and the Stormlight Archives is now not a classic fantasy setting. It's not a Tolkien world, right?
Right.
So things are very different, and you're just getting started very there, different. And you'll learn all about the crab people. But there's things are very, very different, and so he gets to explore the way things are described in a very creative, open-ended way.
Yeah.
And more sandboxy.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, way more sandboxy.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's it's a constraint that I recognize as part of it. And I think you did a good job fitting in the world there, but was a constraint. The combat scenes, I think, were really well done. They obviously represent a large portion of the book. There's these major arcs and major sequences, and they're summed up by the battle scenes, right?
Yep.
But you took the battles and kind of broke them down into, now I know how you play Kings of War too. You like to deploy things in combat groups.
Yeah.
So you had these battles structured in, you know, like flank, center, flank or combat groups. And there's in the forest, there's the earth elementals with the rangers and they're the ironclad or whatever. And they're fighting. And so you could kind of see that there's like, oh yeah, this is where you're fighting with the flank. This is the objective, fighting from the center. Oops, somebody made a move on me here. I wasn't expecting that. So it played out like a game, but you bounce between like the sections in a way to kind of tell the narrative of a battle without it becoming this unit moves here. And then this other unit moves here. And then this unit charged over there. And
right.
It took on a more narrative feel, and I enjoyed that. I mean, I've read a lot of fantasy novels over the years. I think you did a really good job characterizing a large battle scene.
Thank you. That is, it was, you know, when I wrote it, the three things that I wanted it to be, and I kept saying it over and over. I was like, it's got to be clear, and it's got to be cool. Right. The two things, it has to be clear and it has to be cool. So you have to understand what's happening and you have to go, ooh, this is awesome. Right. I see what's happening. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, it being boring and clear, like nobody cares. And the other thing, too, is I actually based that battle on a pair of medieval fights, battles in one was from the War of the Roses and one was from King Stephen and Queen Matilda's fight. Their war. So I looked at the way that, you know, I was like, okay, so the one is mostly infantry and the other one has cavalry. what did they try to, you know, what did they try to do? And the Abyssal Dwarves in this instance had the quote unquote the cavalry, right?
Okay.
And yeah, and so I was able to take that, those two battles, I put them together. And I said, well, what about this, right? And that was pretty much I sketched it out that way. And then I was like, okay, so how do I tell the story? Well, I have point of view characters all over the place.
Right. Right.
And so by doing it from their point of view, I was able to describe what happened step by step by step, character flaws, character bonuses, you know, or their, you know, whatever it is that makes the character them. Right. And was able to tell that really well. I was really happy with the big battle came out awesome. Right. As far as I'm concerned, I was so happy with it. There was one other set of sections. There was about 2000 words, 3000 words that I had to cut. And it was just one other group of free dwarves that were up on the hill that got taken on the left-hand side. I wrote that section out. It was really good writing. And Brandon was like, we're like over. This is the longest Kings of War novel that we've had. I need you to cut some space. And I was like, oh no, right? So
and that right. was like not as important to the plot, so it had to go.
Yeah, so it had to go, right?
Oh, okay.
But, to John's point, I do think your battles evoke, they are clear, they are exciting, like you said, they evoke a sense of Kings of War. Without you just being like, and the shield breakers strapped on Sir Jesse's boots of striding and charged into the flank, thereby doubling their attack.
Yes.
Like, you know, like it's not like a battle report, but it does like, there's like those little markers or touchstones that are like, oh yeah, this is Kings of War.
It's totally Kings of War. Right. Exactly.
Right. So yeah, it was good. Some criticisms.
I'm ready.
Because it wouldn't be. It wouldn't be a fair review if I didn't dislike some parts of it. So I talked about the parts where you're constrained, right? And again, I totally recognize that that's a back and forth. So I don't want it to come across as too harsh of a criticism.
Sure.
And that came at, again, the benefit of familiarity, but awkwardness perhaps in the word choicing sometimes.
Sure.
I found one editing mistake where an entire sentence was duplicated.
I found it too. I was like, why is this here? I was, yes. That was great.
Copy paste there.
Please,
oops.
Please continue. Right.
Yeah. Oops. Oh, well.
Yeah.
I didn't love certain aspects of the character names, and it wasn't the names themselves. It was the use of nicknames. It was really hard, particularly in the beginning, for me. It like took me out of the story to think, who the hell is Deese? Is Deese Reese or is Reese Dare and Dare? Like the names were too similar to have nicknames. And I think you could have stuck more with nicknames or stuck more with formal names. And so I'm going somewhere with this. So been reading Sanderson, Stormlight Archives, the main characters in those books all have nicknames, but they're used very sparingly. Or they have a nickname and their formal name is used very sparingly.
Right.
Like I'm sorry. So you don't. I'm not going to say anything about the actual names themselves because you don't know some of those characters yet.
Thank you.
nice like that.
Right.
But yeah, like it was a little bit too fluid back and forth with the use of nicknames, and so that it broke the fluidity of those dialogue sections.
I can see that.
Totally. I could be the only one. I don't know if Greg felt that as well, or if that was just my brain not. You know, working properly to make those connections.
I think it's compounded by the fact that when you look at the names the first time, you probably don't know how to pronounce them.
Yeah.
So that is like adding to that.
The other major mistake that I made, and this, I didn't even think of that until I started writing the book. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to make the change, is that Dinadek is very similar to Dianek. Which is very similar. You know what I mean? Like there's enough of the D names already in the dwarf culture. Right. Yeah. Where if I had just stayed away from the D names, right. And had some more changes, but you'll also notice like the ancillary characters are, there's Reese and there's Rorik. And I just got stuck on letters that I knew and Rorik and Tordek and
right.
And I was like,
right.
So, and you know, I'm random dwarf name generator. beepity blue, right? And next thing you know, I'm midway through it, and I'm like, oh, son of a, because, you know, I'm writing, and then I go back to read it, and I'm like, I am not changing all these names. Right? But maybe I should have. Right?
Yeah. So, okay.
Right.
Well, anyway, maybe lesson learned on the, something to watch out for in your next book, right?
Right. Absolutely.
And like you said, you were given the names of the places, which can also be very challenging. So you don't have to worry about that. And I also remember having a conversation with you when you were writing the book about what the name of the boat should be.
Yeah.
Sorcy's boat, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we talked about what makes a good name and what should it evoke and stuff like that.
But right.
As an author, you know, you're not just choosing that for a freaking boat. You're choosing it for every single character in the story as well. So it's a lot to make that all fluid.
Yeah. It's, some mistakes were made.
Yeah.
To be honest, right?
So last criticism then. Maybe not a criticism. The story was fairly predictable, which maybe is okay if that's intentional, right? Like the twist was foreshadowed towards the end, but was kind of like easy to figure out even well before there was actually any formal foreshadowing. So if it wasn't meant to be a surprise, then that's fine. Where I was thinking back to is, you know, a lot of times when you're reading a Dresden novel, which obviously is a different style of writing, but
right, a mystery. Right?
They're supposed to be mystery novels, exactly. And so the twists in those are like, they're the twists that you didn't see coming. It's the thing that it wasn't really foreshadowed. It comes out of left field, and it like, oh yeah, I guess that connection could be made. But you definitely weren't going to see it coming. This one you saw coming all the way through.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right, there's gambling in this establishment. I'm shocked. Yeah, like totally.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So again, like if that's not supposed to be a big surprise, then okay, it wasn't. That's fine.
Right. Right.
So overall, Mike, I think you did a fabulous job. It was great. Okay. I really like legitimately enjoyed reading it, which for somebody writing their first book, I think is a huge win. And although it's not perfect, right? I think you did a really, really great job.
Oh, thank you. Right. I know that, like, I've actually felt like if I was going to do this again, there are a couple changes. There are a couple really basic story changes that I would make, right, to be honest. But until I get on Countercharge and talk about the book, et cetera, I'm probably not going to do that because I want people to read it before I tell you all the things I think stink.
Sure.
Right. But, sure. There are some creative changes that I would definitely make going into it, especially knowing now, too, when I was writing all this, I didn't know what Brandon's expectations were as an editor.
Sure.
Right. And so that changed things too. I was like, this thing is fantastic. It's perfect. It's a work of art. And he's like, actually, Mike, just so you know, right, you really need to improve this. You need to improve that. And I was like, yeah, damn it. You're right. Son of a gun. Where were you before? Where were you when I was writing all this drivel? Right. So like, you know, there's definitely changes that I would want to make for the second one. Because, you know, once again, now that I kind of know what the expectations are.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
So yeah, it'll be cool. But so thank you actually for the feedback. That's awesome. Right? Especially since I agree with all of it.
If we had disagreed, that is not good feedback.
No, it would have been great feedback too. It just would have been like, okay, I really need to think on this, right? But no, it's awesome. Cool. Okay, so we probably should we take a break? Take a break and then talk about Kings of War?
Let's do it.
All right, cool. All right, so we're gonna take a break. Ready? We'll see you guys in a couple seconds. And we're back. Hello, friends. Welcome back. Thanks for sticking with us.
Hey, hey.
Hey, hey.
Still here.
All right. So let's talk. We're still here. So let's talk Kings of War, right? Yeah. So we had, Greg, we had a Clash of Kings update while you were making a little human, where you were crafting a person.
Yes. Yes, we did.
Yep, and it includes such innovations as command dice and a bunch of changes to a bunch of different factions. Most of them for the better, actually, which is kind of cool.
That's what you ask.
Yeah,
well, so we got a new list for Forces of the Abyss.
Yeah,
and we have super updates. Awesome. Is this a new list for Trident Realms 2?
It's updates for Trident Realms. They're not as
not as much as
no,
Abyss.
No, yeah. Certainly not. I think the Abyssals feel different than they used to.
Yeah, they do.
Right? But Trident Realms kind of feel the same. There isn't enough there is the, I think, the consensus from the community, to be
there
honest.
Isn't enough, like literally not enough unit profiles?
Not enough changes to make the army be...
Feel different. Ah, I see.
Yeah, notice better or fear different, right? Play different on the table. You know what I mean? Like Abyssals now, because they have the new unit types and the synergies between the units are, I mean, you really can lean into regen. The new way sacrificial imps work really protect you from shooting by giving that one round of high defense, right? Like those actually fundamentally, and then the berserkers, right? I think, and then Nagari, they fundamentally change the way the army can be built, mm-hmm. which is super cool, right? I know a couple people, Alex Chavez, I think, included, are bringing Abyssals. Ray Shields is bringing Abyssals to Dead of Winter.
Right? Oh, very nice.
And their lists are pretty legit. They are pretty legit, all things considered. But so, yeah. And yeah, actually, as we're recording this, Dead of Winter is like less than 2 weeks away.
Yes,
I got all the lists. I got all the lists in from everybody. And it is very interesting to see who has leaned into the changes, right? From the latest Clash of Kings, right? Especially the use of command dice, etc., you know. But Greg, I know we've been talking offline in the chat. It's funny, like Greg a couple days ago was like, I'm coming to Dead of Winter, comma. I should probably take a look at Clash of Kings, comma.
Yep.
How do people use command dice? Right?
I have no clue what's going on.
Seriously, like we have this big like northeast region kind of chat where a lot of people dive in and talk. And I think the consensus with command dice, Greg, is like there's a bunch of generic commands that you can use. And everybody gets a white, blue, and a red command dice just to start, right? And then you can invest additional points into getting additional red, white, or blue command dice. The red ones are best, I think, or the blue ones are best because they give you...
Blue's best, red is the worst, white's in the middle.
Right, and so, you know, depending on how much money or how many points you want to spend, you can get these extra dice to give you extra, hopefully, command points in a given turn. The normal commands are pretty reasonable. I think the community is pretty happy with them for the most part, from what I have heard, right?
Mm-hmm.
It gets into the fact that the faction-specific command dice are they're pretty uneven. Some commands are really good, and other commands are not as good.
Isn't that part of the balance of the army, though? Like, if the unit entries in the list are slightly underpowered, for instance, but you have really good commands, that could be a balance play. And you might even, in like another update, you could change the commands or change the unit profiles, and it gives you another lever to pull to kind of like tweak how the game plays out.
Yeah, that's totally true. Right? I totally see that. I agree. It is interesting to me. Like, so for example, right? One of the commands that you can give in Forces of Nature, or I believe some flavors of Undead, is you can just tell a unit to ignore shambling for a turn.
Oh, that's huge.
Yeah. Especially if you're looking
at crazy.
Multiple people are bringing Forces of Nature with greater air elementals and being like, you don't have to shamble now. 20 inches up the board and turn inside. Oh my God. Right. So like that's a thing.
That's a thing.
Right. The dwarf one is actually really the Imperial dwarf one is really impressive. For 4 points, you can get +1 crushing strength on the counter charge with any unit,
which is actually it's like the rule the berserkers have. It's called vengeance.
Yeah.
But it is a +1. So like even the berserkers then would get +2 crushing strength on a counter charge, which is pretty nice. It's like a free Bane chant. you know, that is situational, but dwarfs are often counter charging.
they certainly are. Right.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Right. And then for free dwarves who are also, so Imperial dwarves don't need the help, right? Like they're really good. but you can give them plus one strength now on the counter charge. Free dwarves, their big one is not that, but instead I think they can give them a 5-up regen on a unit for a turn, right? So like your hordes of shield breakers.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that run through the woods and take a punch. It's like, well, we're just going to shrug off some of that damage, right?
And their other one gives a unit strider until the end of turn.
Which is amazing. That's
also quite right? good.
You take walls and shove it. Right.
And I like the Forces of Abyss have one, and I think a couple other armies have it too, where a unit with regen gets to reroll all of its regen rolls that fall below the end value. So, like, reroll all your failures. And you combine that in Forces of Abyss with the chariot unit that, like, lets all the other units around it get plus one regen. So they're regen 4 up.
Right.
So your units are re-rolling a 4-up regen. That's pretty nasty.
Yeah, right. So Mike, you know,
when you say a unit, an ability costs 4 points, what's the scale on that? Like, what, 4 out of 10 for the game, or 4 out of 6 for the game? Or like,
no, at the beginning of
the dice are for.
Yeah, so at the beginning of your turn, you roll the dice, and however many symbols you get, right, you get that many command points to spend in that turn.
Which is why we're saying the dice are different. Like the red die has like some blanks and ones.
Yeah.
Whereas like the blue die has like triple sword icons on it.
You're not buying something that's a fixed resource that you use. It's still a variable resource that could
it's a variable resource.
Right.
And you you can buy the extra dice. And what's kind of interesting about that is that they're attached to a unit, mostly to like heroes. And if that hero is routed, you don't get the die anymore.
Right.
So you want to like consider that and be selective. And then you don't generate command dice on turn 7. So you normally at the end of your turn, if you unspent command dice, just go away. But at the end of turn 6, if you go to a 7, you carry over the ones that you didn't use in 6. So then you have to actually, like, that's another thing to factor in towards the end of the game.
When about you roll resource those dice. Management, are you going to?
Yeah, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Right, it's legit. So, I'm looking at the, like I said, the Dead of Winter lists, and there are some people that really took a look at that. They took a look at the commands, and then they leaned into it. Right, you can totally see there was some people who were thinking in terms of command dice and what they could do with them. And there are other people that just, you know, probably didn't play as much, haven't been on the front of the curve, and they're like, I'm just going to take the army I normally take. And hey, look, I have these spare command dice now that'll allow me to do a couple cool things during the game. You know. But it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out from my perspective, because I don't have a feel. So let's say you decide you are going to do, I'm going to lean into this command dice thing. You're still rolling dice. You know what I mean?
Yep.
You're still rolling dice. And all of the vagaries that entails, you know what I mean? So I'm going to be interested to see how people adapt to that as the game goes on. You know what I mean?
Right. Are they going to get frustrated when their command dice come up shy on the turn?
Or to be honest, a vast majority of the commands increase the offensive capability of your units.
Mm.
Right. And so you may have people that are on the wrong side of someone getting hot command dice a couple turns in a row.
Right.
And all of a sudden either being able to pull off maneuvers that make it so they get their face smashed, or even just skew the dice in a given direction. Right. And maybe, I don't know if it'll create feel bad moments or not in a game that is so deterministic, you know, except for this thing. Is randomness fun? I think it's cool, right? Because if not, I would play chess. But at the same time, I don't know if that ideal is shared by everybody,
right?
You know what I mean? But anyway, I mean, I am interested to see what the future holds, you know, as far as that goes. So, and the nice thing is I don't have to play in it. I just get to watch everybody.
Yeah, you just get to collect the data.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And then just, you know, use it for the future. I am, just in terms of hobby, I am putting together a Wood Elf, a Sylvankin army. And, you know, their commands, all right, right? Get an extra 6 inches on your shooting, and I think the other
That one's pretty hot.
It is pretty hot, right? But I actually think in terms of the basic maneuver ones, I actually think are better. But, you know, that's just me. So anyway, I'm interested to see how it all plays out. I am looking also at the army list that were submitted. Once again, just for my one tournament. But boy, people love flyers. I mean, apparently on Kingdoms of Men, no one walks unless you're a peasant. But I think most people have these little atrophied, sad legs. And just, you know what I mean? They can barely hold their own weight up because they're all flying around on beasts with wings.
The Kingdom of Men those flying creatures actually eat humans, so the Kingdoms of Men just are like farms feeding their flying beasts, who then go to battle to protect their livestock. People. Yeah,
right? We've talked about this before, the abundance of certain unit types in the game, right? But I don't know, where do you fall on that? Like, it is a fantasy game, so yeah, like it's not just a bunch of dudes on the ground. If you could play a historical version or something, if you wanted that, but. Is it a, you know, is there a limit? Is there a problem if everything just flies?
I personally don't think it's a problem, to be honest. I do wonder, in a game, once again, where speed is king, because it allows you to hit first.
Yeah,
right? It is a big deal. And also, it gets to be quite the geometric puzzle when you have a lot of, like, 50 mil or 75 mil flyers with seven or eight attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to protect all your flanks. Gets really exhausting, right? And because you're inevitably going to make a mistake, you're going to lose a unit. It's going to be sad. And then your line blows up and that's the end of that, right? That's really kind of what the game devolves into when you have that many flyers on the table.
Yeah, because they get to kind of come at you from too many angles and it's hard to cover.
Right. And so they're essentially dictating the game with their speed and the threat of it all, which is totally cool. I don't know whether the pricing for some of that is good or the defense stat for some of that is good. Right. Like, so for example, if you play against Order of the Green Lady, the going thing now is 1, 2, 3, 4 hordes of Forsaken Cav. So it's the flying, right? It's the Order of the Forsaken. So it's flying.
Pegasus Knights.
Playing Pegasus Knights. And oh my God, right? So it's like, okay, everything moves 10 and everything hits like trucks, right? It's find me an elf army that doesn't have the Drakon formation, right? But it's, I don't know if the price is right for those. Or more importantly, I don't know if the defense 5 is appropriate for things that move that fast and hit that hard.
You know, that,
maybe,
yeah, that,
maybe
that
the idea be, would be it'd sure. be defense 4, you know, something. To make it so the obvious choice isn't so obvious.
Right.
You know what I mean? But also, I'm a grump. You know? And to your point, John, like, it is a fantasy game. And there should be fantastic elements to it. And it shouldn't be a problem if you have peg knights. Right? It shouldn't. You know?
If as long as that's the game you want to play. Right?
As long as that's the game.
By they, I mean, like, we all have to, you know.
Yeah. Right.
If we all agree this is a fantasy game, it's going to have those elements, so be it. You know, there's also, I don't know, there's also artillery that takes units off in one shot, so it goes both ways, although that's less prevalent just because of...
That's less prevalent, I think.
Some of the artillery interactions, but yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Right. But I don't know. Like, I don't see it as a problem per se. I don't know. I have not played because of my life and the things we have going on, like this promotion is taking a lot of time, right? So I haven't actually had a chance to play very often. Like, I went to a one day out in Western Mass. Shout out to Dan Start and those guys. They're fantastic. And I took some Sylvankin, and I did really well with the Sylvankin. I was very happy to play it. But that's like the height of my Kings of War. Besides that, and then the book and then running this event, I really haven't had a chance to play too much. So I haven't even used command dice yet, right? But, you know, Keith Conroy was like, we're doing command dice. So I was like, sure, we're doing command dice. Right? Who am I to say no, right? And then we'll find out, like, oh, my God, Mike, why'd you do this, right? But whatever.
Well, I want to – we don't need to go into this in depth necessarily because it's maybe a whole different topic in itself. But many other games have command-type mechanics with resource management. And I think it's a good thing for King's of War to have that as well. Because I think generally they're good things for the game. There's probably an argument to be made that they slow the game down a little bit, which – Your Kings of War, you're playing on a clock, so whatever. It's your time. Spend it however you want. But generally, I think it adds a layer that's useful just for the game in general. I think it's healthy for the game to have that extra. It's not just about movement anymore. There's also some resource management part of it, which you just didn't have before in Kings of War. So I like it.
Yeah, I see that. Totally.
Yeah, I'm excited to try it out this at this event in a couple weeks, and I'm playing my dwarfs. I didn't really change what I have in my list or consider how the command dice would affect my list choices because I'm just taking what I take. But I did buy an extra white die because I wanted to have some more points hopefully at my disposal to play with just to test the stuff out, and it just looks like fun. Then the other part, I mean, there are some there's some updated rules changes and things to like magic artifacts or special rules and stuff. Shout out to the Inspiring Talisman, which now, like, if you give it to a unit with Inspiring, they get very Inspiring, which is cool. I like that.
It's a cool change, right?
Yeah, but now there are some very different scenarios. It's been a while since we've had new scenarios, and there are some that are very different. And I'm interested to see how those go.
Me too.
And so really what I mean by that is there's two scenarios that have progressive scoring.
Yeah.
And John, do you want to explain what that is? Because you've encountered it in multiple games that you play.
Yeah, so Kings of War has classically been about scoring. You win or lose the scenario at the end. Now there's things that happen during the game, like you pick up a loot counter, and so you haven't technically scored it yet, but you're like in control of it, you know. So there's stuff like that but you're not actually getting the points. Progressive scoring is where you score on a per round basis, something along those lines. So at the end of turn, maybe not even starting turn one, but let's just say all the turns. At the end of turn one, you're playing Pillage. You've got three of the four tokens under your control. You score 3 points or 5 points per objective or whatever it is. And you accumulate them across the game. So winning at the beginning might mean you can lose at the end.
Right.
Yes.
Or vice versa. You could be winning and lose all your models, but still win because you held out early enough, and then you got wiped out later on. But getting wiped out later on is too late.
Right.
I like those mechanics.
I do too, because they one of the scenarios is called Rack and Ruin, right? And the cool thing about Rack and Ruin is there's a token in the center of the table, and you score a point at the end of the game if you own that, but there's two 12-inch circles set 18 inches to either side. You control
on the center line.
Line. And what happens is that if you control either of those circles, if you have more unit strength within those circles in turns 3, 4, and 5, you get points and scores in rounds 3, 4, and 5. So it's for the middle of the game, you want to control those areas. And then at the end of the game, you're like, those aren't important at all. I need to get to the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And I like that idea.
It's interesting because it makes for 7 total possible points.
Right.
So there's a lot of different ways that could play out.
Absolutely. Right. It makes for, I think, an interesting game. And you, again, like you really have to figure out, I love the idea of this is important, go get it. Okay, it's not important anymore. It doesn't even matter.
Go get Ditch something
it.
Else.
Go somewhere yeah. else. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. I did back when I was running Warhammer events for the local team or the local scene, I would do interactive scenarios where if you had a unit at a given location at a given turn, you would able to make some sort of something happen. Right. And so right. it behooved you to control that location. Like for one, it was like there was a map and there was a dam. If you controlled the dam at the end of turn four, you had the opportunity to flood a portion of the table. Right. It was stuff like that. That was like super cool. And then afterwards, it's like, you know, it's not the thing that wins the game. Right. But it's the thing that's super cool and will probably help you win the game later. Right. So that you had a mission for your dudes to do. Right. And this syncs up with that. I like it quite a bit, actually. So the rules for Dead of Winter is we did the rule of two. So you can't have more than two of any unit and size combination, right? So you can have two regiments of something, two hordes of something, two troops of something, but you can't have three regiments of something, right? I was trying to reduce spam.
Yep.
And it makes for slightly different lists. And then the other thing is it's 2150, so it's not a number that we use most of the time. Which I
2150,
also think is cool.
But
because yeah,
you actually get more points.
Yes, because it's held at Zombie Planet. And we're the Shambling Horde, everybody gets a free horde of zombies. Right? And you also get a free Tome of Darkness to give on one of your characters, so you can surge that horde of zombies.
So pretty cool. I have a quick question.
I'm ready.
Can I give that Tome of Darkness to a character that already has surge and then get the, like, the rule of the magic artifact is you get +3?
Yeah.
Totally. So it doesn't have to be someone who's a non-surge caster already.
Nope. Absolutely not.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, pretty simple. So, and then the scenarios, I'm taking scenarios out of the book, but if the horde of zombies is in a given spot during the course of the game, or if the guy who's holding the tome is doing a certain something, they will get a bonus. Every game, right?
Yes.
Depending on what's happening, right? So I have those special rules written up for each of the scenarios. They're not game breaking, but they add a little bit of flavor.
A little local flavor,
right? Yeah, to entice you to do something with them besides stick them in the corner and act like they're not there.
Right.
You know? Right. Which, you know, sometimes it happens. So yeah, so it'll be cool. Right? It'll be cool. I'm interested again. I love this event because the crowd is always great. And people seem to love it, because they keep coming back. And I also like we have the whole venue for the weekend. Essentially George shut the place down. He's like, this is for you. So on Saturday, Sunday, it's just gonna be us in there.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Like, we have run of the place.
That's awesome.
Good. Yep. Food's gonna be provided, and then it's gonna be a good time. I love the community, man. So anytime I get a chance to like hang out with everybody, it's like, even though I'm gonna be busy, it's super awesome. Makes me feel good. But anyway, and I'm really excited. Like I think we mentioned earlier, like a couple days ago, Greg was like, I think I can go to Dead of Winter. Do you have any tickets? I was like, buy one right now, right? So super happy you're coming out, Greg. Beyond pleased, right?
Yes, I'm very excited.
Get away, yeah.
And I'm gonna bring my gosh darn copy of Honor's Price and get it signed.
It's happening. I will do it.
Because I missed you at Crossroads.
I know, right? Such a sad state of affairs. But oh, have we spoken since Crossroads?
No.
We need to talk about your charity. Just real quick, like, how much money did you raise for charity?
That event went great. Thank you. We need to talk about that, but we need to do it in the next episode because it's been so long. Like, the details of this event, which I want to actually chronicle for the historical record and for the general public's enjoyment.
Right.
But I want to make sure I have it all, and so I have to look back through my stuff.
Yeah.
But I will say we raised more money than I was expecting. I worked my butt off, but had a lot of fun. And the feedback I got from it was overwhelmingly positive. And I heard some folks say, like, why doesn't this happen at every GT?
Yes. Which is the best praise ever, right?
It sounded so fun. Like, people really, really did speak praises to it. So, yeah, you have to give it more. When we got more time to dig into it, it's worth it.
Yes.
Yeah. That's something to look forward to next.
We have to give it its due. Absolutely. Right. Mm-hmm. So, super cool. I'm so proud of you, man. You know?
Thank you.
But love it. All right. Is there anything else that we would like to discuss today, friends? Because it's like 10:15.
Yeah, I think given the time constraint, we'll probably be happy we were able to get together and record tonight.
Absolutely.
We talked about it. We are gonna try to do a better job of getting out some more regular content. Probably is going to require us to make some format changes, not like anything dramatic, but we probably need to rely on some guests a little bit more to fill the ranks when we can't get the three of us together at the same time.
Yeah, so, I think that often ends up being kind of what holds us back, is it's hard to line up our schedules to get all three of us. But if what we're thinking is, like, if we can get at least two of the hosts and a guest, and we'll probably have some regular recurring guests with voices you've heard on the cast before, and perhaps some new ones. But, you know, that way, even if all three of us can't make it, we can still put something out that we're, you know, proud of the quality and everyone's satisfied with. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So keep your eyes out. We'll be there.
Yep.
We're still here.
There'll be more content.
And I'll post plenty of Space Marine pictures to keep let you know that I'm still around. So.
With all sorts of background colors. Gotta give the people what they want.
That's right. It's a cornucopia.
And with nail polish?
maybe for nostalgia, I should do one with nail polish.
Just, man, I am amazed at the pen ink story.
I love that.
Right?
So dude, ridiculous. This is the. There was no. Who was going to tell me?
Right? Well, true. Right? I mean, back then.
Look at that. I've come so far.
You totally have. I feel like I'm still there. All right. All right, buddies. It was nice catching up with you guys. And here comes the closing bumper. Get ready. I'll see you in a couple of weeks, Greg, at Dead of Winter. Doing some interviews while I'm there, and then we'll post those up. It'll be good. All right, dudes.
Awesome.
Be well, everybody.
Good night.
Later, everybody.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you like what you heard.
If you have any thoughts about the episode, please find us on Facebook and leave us some feedback. And if the spirit moves you, leave us a review on iTunes and work that algorithm.
Special thanks to Robbie P. and the Countercharge Podcast Network for hosting us. And to all you listeners, y'all are awesome.